Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The day after a remarkable episode in the Oval Office. I mean, we've seen this before, right? I mean, the president rage tweeting and then melting down the president in the presence of a president of a foreign country. This is not new. Or is it? As the House impeachment process continues. And the lead story in the Washington Post, at least at the moment that we're recording right now, is Trump involved Mike Pence in efforts to pressure Ukraine's leader. Although Pence has, his folks are saying that he had no idea. He was unaware of the allegations in the whistleblower complaint. So this is a good day to talk with the author of the new book about Mike Pence, Tom Lobianco, whose book Piety and Power comes out at a very, well, an interesting moment in our political history. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you, Charlie.
You know, I was mentioning right before we started that I'm torn between thinking that Mike Pence is one of the most boring human beings in the world, kind of the Ken Doll of American politics. Mm-hmm. Versus thinking that he's also just a real puzzle, that there's the paradox of Mike Pence. And reading your book and listening to you talk about it, Mike Pence is a much more complicated character than he portrays himself as being. But it's an interesting choice, isn't it?
Yes. And you know, when I was reporting this, acquaintance who had known him, not a close friend, but someone whose careers had tracked somewhat closely since the 1980s, put it this way. He said, boring is his camouflage. And it's right. And he's right. Because, I mean, I remember when I started covering him back in 2011, well, it was pretty clear he was going to win the governor's race and that this was going to be the guy in there for the next, you know, 4 years. And we were coming off covering Mitch Daniels. You know, Mitch Daniels as a governor is fascinating to cover. He, you know, interesting ideas, getting these big political spats. And certainly you remember it because Scott Walker went and ran the Mitch Daniels playbook out in Wisconsin. And you know, you'd have these big, as far as journalism goes, there was news happening all the time. And I stared down a Mike Pence governorship. I'm like, wow, this is, nothing's going to happen. And it's just going to be, right? But that's the thing, right? It's like you get behind the mask and it's like, wait a minute, there's a lot going on.
You describe him as the ultimate political shapeshifter.
Yes. Yeah. You know, the funny thing about him, and I didn't understand this until I kind of pulled back and did the chronology and kind of laid things in there, you know, try to re-report his first two congressional races, his career in radio, how he gets back into politics in 2000, his rise through Congress. And what I found with him is that he's a lagging indicator of where the politics of the moment is. And he kind of catches the wave just as it's cresting. And that's sort of that political caution. And he's certainly not the first politician to be like that. It's a little more pronounced with him. And I think that also goes to the idea of like boring as a way of dampening it. Because, you know, look, the first time he runs for Congress, he trains at Newt Gingrich's campaign school. When Gingrich in 1987 takes over GOPAC. And they're laying the pipeline for the 94 Gingrich revolution. And I just remember that the official version of events that Pence's people would give, whenever you'd ask about, like, you know, how he got his start, they're like, oh, well, he ran a very positive race in 1988 and then a very negative race in 1990. He learned his lesson and he never did negative politics ever again. Well, that was wrong because he ran a very negative race in 1988 and 1990. And the reason we know that is, well, one, by going through the archives, but two, that's the playbook from Newt Gingrich. That's what, when they were handing out the training manuals, and I got a copy of one on eBay. I paid $100 for this thing. It's great. I love it. It is Flying Upside Down. It is the challenge written by Joe Gaylord, the right-hand man to Gingrich, right? I know. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, of course, you know this because it's like, I mean, this is, you know, famous conservative Republican history. Like, this is what leads to the Gingrich Revolution. Pence is an early soldier, an early recruit in the Gingrich Revolution, but he doesn't survive long enough to actually catch that wave to Washington because, you know, who catches it is David McIntosh. McIntosh catches that ticket instead of him.
But the boring is fascinating because as a talk radio guy, and he and I have actually discussed this. You know, one of the prime directives of talk radio is not to be boring, but boring has become now his survival mechanism. So I want to come back to all of this, the story that you tell, the rise of Mike Pence and what's he become. Let's start off with current day. Let's start off with today. This story in the Washington Post that Trump repeatedly involved Pence in the efforts to exert pressure on the leader of Ukraine at a time when the president was using other channels to solicit information that he hoped would be damaging to a Democratic rival. Of course, you know, Trump instructed Pence not to attend the inauguration of Zelensky back in May, used Pence to tell Zelensky U.S. aid was still being withheld. And then, of course, this key paragraph, officials close to Pence insist he was unaware of Trump's efforts to press Zelensky for damaging information about Biden and his son, who had served on the board of a blah, blah, blah. Everybody knows all of this. So what is going on here? Are the Pence folks trying to distance themselves from this scandal? Are the Trump folks trying to throw him under the bus? What's your read of where we're at right now in the very interesting, complicated Trump-Pence relationship?
Yeah, boy, that was a blockbuster story from the Post. And where they started, we're about 1 week into an official impeachment inquiry right now. The first major hint of this is when Donald Trump goes out at this UN press conference and says, oh, maybe you ought to ask for Mike Pence's tapes.
Just love that.
Prior to this story, what you saw Pence's people doing was carrying the message, saying that, look, there's nothing wrong here. I mean, Pence himself in that big Sean Hannity interview he did from the UN last week says that there's nothing wrong here. You know, this is just about corruption, et cetera. And he's delivering the message. So the fact that they're trying to insulate him is a key indicator of the peril that he faces right now. There's some feeling, I've heard from a few people, that it looks like Trump is wrapping his arms around Mike Pence as a survival mode. You know, certainly don't want, look, there's some fear there, right? There's some paranoia, some fear about whether Mike Pence would be used to push Trump off the cliff. There's never, based on my reporting from the campaign, from this administration, there's never been a sort of a complete trust of Trump from Trump of Mike Pence. Now, it goes the other way. There's just complete loyalty from Mike Pence. But the thing is that it's, and his people say this, you can't ever give enough to Donald Trump because it'll never change anything.
Well, complete loyalty, but also very clearly a lot of annoyance at the way that Trump treats Pence. So it may be public loyalty, but there are a lot of tensions beneath the surface.
Yes.
And I guess one of the questions would be is, oh, these people, quote unquote, close to Pence, who are telling the Washington Post, we knew nothing about this. This was not our deal. We were not part of this. That seems to be a little bubbling up of this. That we're not going along with this. We aren't part of this train.
You know, it reminds me of where Pence was during the Trump-Russia investigation. Mm-hmm. He was able to wall himself off in large part because he was involved in a lot of this stuff. He involved people from the campaign from before he joined. But now he's squarely in the middle of it, and they're in survival mode. And, I mean, it's, you know, ironically enough, it's where they've always been, you know, looking down the road to 2024 for his own presidential ambitions. Everything is about surviving the Trump presidency, keeping your head low, trying not to draw too much attention, and then plowing forward. But, I mean, you can't. I mean, it's... Yeah.
Does this story or in these tensions, do they pose any real threat to Pence staying on the ticket? Because you've talked about the fact that Jared and Ivanka have certainly, you know, tested the idea of moving on, picking somebody else. So how secure is Pence on the ticket? And does this change anything?
I'm not sure this changes the calculus for the ticket itself. I will say this, everything does feel a little more immediate than November of 2020 right now. I mean, you know, before the official impeachment inquiry was announced and before we started learning more about this whistleblower complaint, there was a lot of talk from inside Trump world that Jared and Ivanka had wanted a woman on there. And their people, let me be clear, their people deny this, say it's not true. But, you know, you remember you saw the Nikki Haley tweet ironically enough, things are so chaotic. I mean, we know this from having been around politics for a while, but things are so chaotic in Trump's political universe that it kind of gives everybody a chance to build their own name recognition and pursue their own political goals. So, you know, in the Nikki Haley tweets, "Oh, it would never be me." Well, that's building her name rec for whatever she wants to do in the future. You know, the tensions were there beforehand. My sense of Pence world right now is that survival is a little more immediate and they're not thinking as long term down the road. You know, I was back in Indianapolis talking with folks for the book over the weekend and ran into a Pence advisor on the plane, and I asked them, you know, how things were going. It says probably, you know, a couple days after the impeachment inquiry had started, and he was just floored. He said, "We haven't had a chance to stop. There's no one's had a chance to take a breath." So I think it's still in crisis mode right now, and certainly that Washington Post article just elevated it even further.
Well, let's go back to election night, because, you know, in terms of like how did Mike Pence get here and what makes him tick, and you've been asked this, I'm sure, in every single interview, and the book did I mention the title of the book, Piety and Power? I don't know whether I did or not, but that's the great thing about podcasts. Well, we'll have it. So the dramatic story of election night, Trump and Pence are elected. Nobody expected that to happen. And in your book, you have this really interesting moment where Karen Pence twice rebuffs her husband when he tries to kiss her. "You got what you wanted, Mike. Leave me alone," she told him. Now, there's also, in Tim Alberta's book, American Carnage, you know, also described Karen as being apoplectic about, you know, Trump's comments. And his behavior, and warned her husband she wouldn't appear in public if he carried on as Trump's running mate. Now, you also describe Karen Pence as Mike Pence's closest advisor. You know, if there's a small Pence circle, it's him and Karen Pence. So take me inside that interaction. Why Karen Pence reacted that way to her husband being elected president of the United States, vice president of the United States.
Yeah, let me, you know, when the first time I'd heard that, my initial thought was, wow, she's really angry at Trump, because I bought into this idea that she's like a shrew, and that she's, you know, the school marm, doesn't like this stuff, you know, a moralist. Yeah, exactly. Right. Everything embodied in that phrase. that's how I viewed it. But the more I reported the book and the more I reported that anecdote in particular, the more it became clear it was a political decision, it was a political calculus, and that's why she was angry. And I think that there are many things that I hope people grasp from the book, and I hope that people are able to see the complexity of Pence himself. But I also hope that they see that Karen Pence and Mike Pence, it's a joint career, and their political acumen develops together. So she is a political creature just as much as he is. And that's not always true of every spousal, political spousal relationship. So, look, where were they in 2016 when they joined the ticket? Part of the decision making that goes into this is, well, Trump, they take a risk, and they never take risks in their career.
They never take risks.
Mm-hmm. Never, never. And this is the one time they do it. So it's a calculated gamble. And the gamble is that Trump will more than likely lose in November of 2016, and then Pence will be positioned to run at the front of the pack for the nomination in 2020. So put her refusing to kiss Mike Pence in that frame, and all of a sudden it makes sense, because she was angry because he had just screwed up their career. Because now they had just went from being stuck with Trump for 4 months to being stuck with him for 4 years. or maybe even 8 years. And when he won, they lost. And I think that she could put up with some of the insanity of the Trump circus for a couple months, but now it's a political lifetime. And worse, it has the ability to rub off and basically erase Pence's image that he had developed over 30 years. He developed this over three decades. And here's Trump. He could, like everything else in Trump world, it could, just be obliterated.
Well, there's been a lot of reporting about what happened in the wake of Access Hollywood and how upset Pence was mm-hmm. and how upset she was. So what does your reporting tell you about that weekend, that famous weekend where the tape is released, where Trump is bragging about grabbing women's pussies on Friday, and then Mike Pence disappears? What was going on in the next 48 hours?
So, I'd heard before about the contingency plan that the Republican Party had for dealing with Trump, sort of the emergency plan for what happened. What would happen if the famous Mark Burnett reality TV tapes with Trump dropping the N-word ever popped up? And you'd always heard some chatter about this, and I didn't entirely believe it because it sounds a little fabulous. And God knows there's enough fabulous stories out of Trump world. So I didn't believe it until I heard that 2 hours, I was talking with Pence's chief political advisor, and he said that 2 hours after the Access Hollywood tapes published, he's already fielding phone calls from Republican Party donors acting on behalf of Reince Priebus. They say they're acting on Reince Priebus's behalf. Priebus says they're not acting on his behalf as a back channel. And for your listeners, that's fairly standard practice to use back channels and sensitive manners. I mean, it's like CIA or something, right? Except it's political. You can roll your eyes at that one. and they're saying, look, we're 2 hours after the Access Hollywood tape drops. They say we're ready to replace Trump on the ticket with Mike Pence. He doesn't even have to say anything. And Marty Obst, the chief political advisor, beats it back. And he says, no, that's ridiculous. We're not going to do that. And the reason why, and again, this goes to understanding why Karen refused to kiss Mike Pence on election night, because of the political calculus, because it would be career suicide. Look where they are in that moment. Look, this is also the reason that Mitch McConnell refuses to sign on to this statement that they were going to circulate between Paul Ryan and Reince Priebus, and they were going to put it out there calling on Trump to step down from the ticket. Why would you ever sign on to something like that if your problem disappears in 30 days?
Right.
Right. It just doesn't make sense.
You just survive for that 30 days. So how did it get resolved, though? How did they decide they were back on the ticket?
Oh, yeah, this is great. So, yeah, they go into hiding. They duck the press. They're in the governor's mansion. And Karen was angry, definitely angry. Although, I'm not entirely sure how much of that was pure anger at Trump and how much of that was her people putting out there that she was angry to kind of protect that image. They go into hiding at the governor's residence. They field a phone call from Trump. He apologizes. But that night, they fly out Saturday night, October 8th, 2016. They decide they're going to fly to a fundraiser for Trump in Rhode Island. And as they're boarding the plane to fly out there from Indianapolis to Rhode Island, Karen looks at Marty Obst, the chief advisor. And she says, you know what? We knew what we were signing up for. We knew that there were going to be moments like this. And our job is to do the job, stick with it. And that's what we're going to do. So, and that is what they do. They go fly out to Rhode Island, I think it was Newport, Rhode Island, do the fundraiser. They hear from the people in the room that there's not a lot of concern over Trump's comments. They're kind of, from those donors in Rhode Island, they hear that this is locker room talk. So they feel pretty good about it. But they're not ready to go back in public just yet and say that they're 100% on the Trump train. They have to wait and see how Trump handles the debate performance the next night, Sunday night. And they watch him, and they watch the publicity stunt where they bring out the Clinton accusers, and they're like, you know what? We're happy with him. We're sticking with him. And then Pence finally reemerges on Monday morning and he says, I'm sticking with Trump. And I think, look, to this Ukraine thing that we're watching right now with the Russia thing, when stuff gets hot, Pence goes into hiding. But that's the, I mean, look at that, the length of that calculation that happens by within 24 hours of the Access Hollywood tape dropping that weekend. They've already made a decision that they're sticking with Trump, but they're deciding how they're going to talk about it in public. And this is like, this is how Mike Pence handles things. You know, I got some questions about what Pence would be like as president. And I think you would go from like, I think methodically, you logistically, you would go from warp speed to like 30 miles an hour.
Yeah, it would be a culture shock for America. Okay, let's turn the time dial back a little bit. Let's go back late 2015 and early 2016. We could go back. You go back all the way to his childhood, but you know, to remind people that 2016 was at the beginning of 2016, Mike Pence was having a terrible, terrible year.
Yeah,
that he really screwed up the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Mm-hmm. And your discussion of that is interesting because I think the image is of Mike Pence is that he's a culture warrior, that yes. He is a, you know, that he, you know, is a firebrand on this issue. And you basically argue that he's not, and that frankly, yeah, he backed into RFRA and really didn't know what was coming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, understand that in that moment. So let's go 2013, he's elected governor, 2014. Those first 2 years of his governorship are basically spent running for president. He's going out, building out his national network of donors. He is not heavily engaged in the job he is in. He's not very engaged at the state house. Objectively, he was not a very good manager. He's not a hands-on manager. Now, I will say this. His people say that he's very laissez-faire because he was a legislator, so he wants the legislators to work their process. I understand that rationale. But he wasn't dialed in. He was not engaged. So, look, what happens in 2014 is the state tries to put the state already bans gay marriage in Indiana, but they were going to put it in the Constitution. And that was as a preemptive measure against what would invariably be a Supreme Court ruling. And Pence, in this moment, I report this for the first time in the book, in that moment, he tells one of his advisors that he just doesn't want to get into it one way or the other. Right, because he wants to wait until the Supreme Court rules on it. And I think this is part of that shape-shifting, because remember, look, he's kind of a Tea Partier when in 2009, 2010, but by the time he decides to run for governor, he is rebranding himself into a Mitch Daniels-style Republican technocrat, kind of like exactly like what Scott Walker and John Kasich were doing at the time. And that was in vogue in the moment. Right. That was the Republican Party autopsy that comes out after Romney loses. We got to get more inclusive, et cetera, et cetera. So Pence is, and that's where the donors are. That's what the donors are telling him that they like. So get to 2015, the RFRA bill, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that bill was not created by Pence. It was created by the state House Speaker, and it was a consolation prize to the religious right because they lost the same-sex marriage ban the year before. And this was the consolation prize, and it sails through the House. It sails through the Senate. There are protests, but nothing on the order of what you saw the year before.
It looked like this was an easy layup. Because it was about religious freedom. It didn't take away anyone's rights. And he thought it was easy. He did not think it was going to be that controversial.
Right. Yeah. What does Reagan say about success has 1,000 fathers and failure's an orphan? This one had 1,000 fathers in that moment.
So what went wrong?
Well, Pence became one of them. And he swoops in at the last minute to take credit for a bill that he had nothing to do with. It was to play to his Christian right base of voters. It's sort of his political past. I mean, what happens is his political past collides with his political future. That Saturday, so he signs the bill on a Thursday, Thursday morning. It's just as like the nation is starting to pick up on this and becomes a cultural moment. There's a flashpoint here. George Takei, Mr. Sulu from the original Star Trek, writes this searing Facebook post in that moment, and he says that he knows exactly what Mike Pence's RFRA bill is. He says it's the same bill that put his family in internment camps. And this is like, it just lights on fire. So Pence gets caught in a viral moment, and he doesn't quite grasp it. So Friday, they don't know what they're doing. They're not, this is just starting to like boil up in a serious way. That Saturday, they get requests to go on Stephanopoulos this week, or Megyn Kelly. So I report this out deeply in the book, and because it's such a pivotal moment in his career, and it also helps us understand his style of faith versus his style of politics. And they're at the governor's mansion. It's probably about a dozen or so of his closest advisors. And there's a split between his advisors. There are the old Christian right types, that's like the James Dobson types, who want him to dig in. And they want him to tell the world that this is not discrimination and that the intolerance is actually coming from the coastal elites and the LGBT folks who are intolerant of religious freedom. But his other advisors, which is more of this like business Republican, Mitch Daniels style Republican, are telling him, no, look, just go out there, tell them that the bill does not discriminate, make clear that it does not discriminate, and maybe you shouldn't take these interviews because you don't want to be the face of this thing. I can tell you that I talked with about a half dozen people that were in that room for that meeting. I heard four or five different versions of events. Of what happened in that room, which is so funny because that is absolutely how meetings with Mike Pence go. You walk out of a meeting, you're not entirely sure what he just told you. The best is the ones who they think they understand. Trump ran into this in April of 2016 when he met with Pence. Trump and Christie ran into that buzzsaw. So they walk out of the room, they're not entirely sure what's going to happen, and he goes on Stephanopoulos the next day, Sunday, and this... He goes on and he has basically a communications meltdown, which is so remarkable for him because he's so good at communications. He's so disciplined. And, you know, I remember I was watching with my girlfriend at the time. She's my wife now. And she's not into politics. She doesn't do this stuff. She's a, you know, non-combatant. And and she was listening to this and she's like, wow, that was terrible. I was like, whoa, you heard that too. And like to the right, like, and like, that's when I realized, I was like, God, this guy's in trouble. And it basically in that moment, his career is over because
certainly his presidential career.
Absolutely. Well, he just became the face of anti-gay bigotry for the entire country. Look, his aides start fielding calls from people saying, you know, wondering if he's going to run for re-election as governor. Forget the presidency here. You know, this has become a life or death situation. One of the things that I report in the book, and this is what I really try to do to understand him, is this guy's a human. And I think that we often lose that when we're covering politics. There's tug and pull between the faith and the ambition, and his principles. And, you know, I've wondered about this for 4 years. Why did he melt down on Stephanopoulos? And I finally got the answer that made the most sense to me from one of his good buddies. He said that in the days after they signed the bill, that Pence was watching Twitter and Facebook, and he was watching these trolls make fun of his children. Right? Now, we just had a kid. My wife and I had a kid. She's 3 years old now, and I did not understand that before. I get it now. He had dad rage. Like, I get that anger. I've never felt like if somebody is attacking my kid, I like won't turn into the Incredible Hulk. Probably not in reality, and I'll probably hurt myself, but I feel that.
You know, this is a very interesting point. And I remember I used to make this point when I was on the radio. It may sound like a cliche, but it's so fundamentally important, is to remember that people in politics are actually human beings.
Yeah.
That they are people just like you, and they have emotions, and they have all of these things. And they go home, you know, after a public event, and they have to explain to their wife what happened. They have kids who watch on television and see what's going on. And I think that that's an element that we tend to lose, especially as things become so heated and so polarized. And that we tend to start thinking of people in public life as sort of entities or institutions, when in fact they are just people.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, I would hear these answers from folks that were telling me, like, all about the political calculations that were going into the messaging as he was going on Stephanopoulos. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Like, it didn't make sense to me. And, like, I heard that and I was like, wow, that is, it's real. And, like, I felt for him in that moment. Now, the flip side of that, and I did ask his friend this, I'm like, okay, but why is he signed on to the ticket with, you know, Facebook and Twitter's ultimate troll?
Yeah, okay, I want to get to that in a moment. So here we are in 2016. His presidential ambitions are done. He's running for re-election. It is by no means a given. There's a lot of speculation that he might not even win in November to keep his own seat. And then comes Donald Trump, who names him to the ticket. So why Pence, given the position that he was in at that moment, why did Trump pick Pence of all people?
So let me, I'm going to hit that here in 1 second, but let me rewind just for 1 minute, because this gets to the faith and the ambition and how he makes decisions. So ultimately, Pence backs down on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And why did he back down? I report this for the first time in the book. No one ever had a really good answer for why he abandoned the Christian right base in this moment and went with the business side Republicans. The answer is that Republican donor Paul Singer, who they have been working on for close to 6 years as an anchor of any presidential run, Paul Singer's son is gay, and he'd come out, you know, like a couple years earlier, super pro-LGBT Republican, calls up Mike Pence and says, if you do not sign the fix to this legislation, making clear that it doesn't discriminate, you will never get any money from me. And Pence signs the fix.
Interesting. I'm guessing that sort of scenario takes place far more often than most of us suspect. Well, some of us suspect it a lot, but
more than we, right? That's the trick, right? Being able to put a finger on it. I mean, you know, this stuff happens, but it's just
that moment where one phone call, one individual, and public policy has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's to the shapeshifter, the calculus. And look, it's a tug and pull between his principles and his ambition.
Okay, so, right? This becomes more of a puzzle, because so he crashes and burns on Stephanopoulos. He becomes the face of anti-gay bigotry, fairly or not. And then he flip-flops. So he's gotten, in some ways, he is in the worst of all possible worlds. So, again, why let's go to the middle of 2016. He's very much damaged goods by then.
Yes. The Trump campaign was having trouble finding candidates to join them. I mean, if you're looking at someone who would easily say yes, then politically damaged goods is a good place to start. Now, there's another reason, too, which is that Pence actually helps with the numbers. In a weird way, Pence was perfectly positioned for Donald Trump, to be Donald Trump's running mate. Maybe not somebody else's, but Donald Trump. Paul Manafort's running the campaign in this moment. They're looking at, like, you're down to some finalists. By June of 2016, end of June, you're basically, you have Newt Gingrich, Chris Christie, and Mike Pence are the big three. And Paul Manafort had his pollster, Tony Fabrizio, run some numbers and on who would help Trump. And Christie and Gingrich don't do anything for you, but Mike Pence brings back evangelicals into the fold. And he also helps with conservative voters. And you remember this because the Ted Cruz conservatives were not on the Trump train in this moment, not at all. And this is how I was able to kind of tease out that Pence is not a Christian right televangelist theocrat. Because why would you hire somebody onto the ticket who is a televangelist if you already have them on your side? And the answer is because Pence's style of faith, his style of practice, is more of a quiet, megachurch, non-denominational evangelical, not the Southern Baptist style that you see from the Falwells and the Pat Robertsons.
So evangelicals are not monolithic, and they recognize that.
Right, exactly. And I think this is a mistake that we make as political reporters. You know, I said it's like, you know, it's like every time that you call Al Sharpton the black leader, right? It's like, is there a single leader of anything, right? It doesn't make any sense. And when you start blocking people together, you lose nuance. And I can guarantee you that Paul Manafort didn't lose nuance because they made a decision, which turned out to be a very good decision, that here was a man who could bring back some of these quiet, quiet Midwestern evangelical types. They knew, and Reince Priebus was part of this too, they knew they would have a problem down ballot where the voters would stay home. They wouldn't vote for Trump or Clinton. And then that creates problems. I mean, the assumption all along is that Trump is going to lose. But if, especially if you're Reince Priebus, now you're starting to worry about Senate races. You're starting to worry about House races. I mean, this thing could become a bloodbath. So Pence is the one who fixes all of that. And yeah, it's at the margins, but it's enough.
And he was a more normal, a normal pick. I've told the story before. You know, Reince Priebus brokered a meeting with Mike Pence a little bit after this with me, and I had been very, 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 you know, vocally anti-Trump. I mean, extremely anti-Trump. And you know, he came into Milwaukee, and we met at the airport, and you know, and I told him, listen, I'm never going to be supportive of Trump. And he says, yeah, but just, you know, can we keep the lines of communication open? And then he tells me a story about how he had been telling Donald Trump that Paul Ryan was like the best person ever, that he was a Paul Ryan conservative. And you could tell, you know, this guys like Reince were very comfortable with this, that here was the Ryan element of this ticket. Now, again, maybe this was part of the shapeshifter that in the room with me and with Reince Priebus, right. He's talking about how he's golfing with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump's asking him, you know, what do you think of this Paul Ryan guy? Oh, he's absolutely fantastic. He is just absolutely wonderful. But whatever. So tell me the story, though, of the plane and the flat tire, because this appears to be more than just a usual, you know, a usual passing blip anecdote.
Well, yeah, before I get into that, yeah. I mean, yeah. what your experience is so true of, I've heard that before, and like in other meetings where Pence is carrying the water for Trump, talking about how everyone's going to be great friends, and they're not. I mean, look, by like when you look forward, he's not great friends with Paul Ryan. They have one of the worst relationships, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, but a lot of things changed from then. So again,
that's right.
We got used to that.
So July 12th, 2016, the campaign is Newt Gingrich has the upper hand in the race for running mate.
Oh, sweet
Jared
Jesus.
Kushner.
I mean, really? But go on.
Well, yeah, that probably would have guaranteed Trump lost.
Yeah, I think so. No, and, yeah.
Gingrich, you know, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump really like Gingrich because he's on TV a lot. He kind of meshes well with their father. He is a big ideas man in a way that Trump is not. Christie also has a line in directly with Trump. He's kind of being blocked by Jared Kushner, but he still has a good direct relationship with Trump. Pence has no relationship with Trump. Zero. And the person, the Hoosier, the guy from Indiana who has a relationship with Trump is a man named Stephen Hilbert. And Hilbert used to be an insurance magnate in the 90s, billionaire, very similar to Trump, with multiple wives. Met his third wife when he was at the bachelor party for his stepson from his second marriage, and she pops out of the paper mache cake naked. So they're actually very simpatico.
The usual story, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, hey, there's a giant cake there over in the corner.
Who brought the naked lady? Yeah,
right, exactly. they had a very close relationship. And, you know, interestingly enough, and it's from the casino world, because remember back then they were doing riverboats, and Trump was actually out in Indiana trying to win licenses. So Trump and a man named Stephen Hilbert are very tight. You know, funny, interesting fact about that, too. Stephen Hilbert is responsible for two things in Donald Trump's world: Mike Pence and his orange tan.
Oh, really? The orange tan? Okay, I'm going to go with this digression. So what is the orange tan story? Because I don't know this one.
Steve Hilbert owns a company. They own the Hilbert and Tommy Sue Hilbert own a company called Australian Gold. And, you know, actually, there is an episode of The Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice, from 2011, where they hawk Australian Gold. It's a tanning product. It's, oh, yeah, yeah. LaToya Jackson and Gary Busey are on the pitch team on Celebrity Apprentice, and it says, and they come up with a line that says, live the gold life. And as I reported this, I mean, the first time I heard this, I could not believe it. I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me that, like, Australian Gold made Trump orange? And, like, the people around Hilbert were insistent that this is the real thing.
This is it. So is it a cream? Is it a lotion? Is it a spray?
Well, it's kind of like a line of tanning products.
Okay.
Plenty of normal folks use it and do not turn orange. I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions on this company. But for whatever reason, Trump uses it and is turned orange. Maybe it's a tanning bed. I don't know that level of detail. I just know that it's Australian Gold, and the Hilberts love it. You know, funny thing is that for
the Hilberts love the fact that he's using their product, even though it makes him look orange. Because yeah. I'm thinking that is not the best advertising for the product.
Hilbert's a little orange himself too.
Okay,
he's a little darker shade of orange.
So they look in the mirror and go, looking fine. This is good. This is what I want. Or it's the light bulbs. It's not me. Right?
Right.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah. So, you know, the funny thing is that Hilbert is Pence and Trump have zero relationship. Kellyanne Conway had set up a meeting with them back in 2011 when Pence was trying to find donors for a presidential run. And you know, Pence goes up to Trump Tower in 2011 and they have a quick meeting. It's like 30 minutes long. Nothing really comes of it. They don't click.
I wouldn't think so,
for obvious reasons, right? Mm-hmm. But in June of 2016, Mike Pence gets a text message from Stephen Hilbert. And it's like kids in middle school passing notes to each other. It says, if you were to be considered seriously for Donald Trump's running mate, would you say yes? And he's astounded. He calls his chief of staff out to meet him. And he shows him his cell phone. Reads it to them, and they're astonished. I mean, they're like, wow, this is Vice President of the United States. Like, the answer has to be yes. And to the point that, you know, that you brought up earlier, that a lot of people were saying no to Donald Trump in this moment. A lot of people didn't want to be associated with him. Mike and Karen Pence have to pray on this. They have to decide, you know, whether this is seriously something that they want to do. And fairly quickly they come up with, yeah, they do want to do this. It starts the vetting process. By the time you get to July 12th, 2016, the Trump is flying into Indianapolis for a campaign fundraiser set up by Stephen Hilbert. Hilbert was a very influential character inside the campaign, not just in Indiana. And you know how Trump is with his kind of his old business friends. The campaign plane pops a tire. It gets stranded in Indiana. And the reason that we know that Pence was another reason we know that Pence was not the top pick was because the original game plan had been that Trump was going to fly on to California for fundraisers, and Pence was going to fly alone to Manhattan to meet with Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump at Trump Tower for the very first time. It was this late in the game because the nominating convention is the next week, seven days.
Okay, so the tire on the plane that grounds Trump, this is legit.
Yes, that was real.
This really happened. This is not Paul Manafort coming up with a cunning way to have a sleepover between Trump and Pence.
Well,
I'm just asking.
Grassy, is there a cake
grassy
in the corner?
Knoll theories, you know. I'm thinking if I'm Donald Trump and I want to go someplace and they say, hey, you know, Mr. Trump, you know, your plane has a flat tire, that he's going to figure out a way to fly anyway, you know. I mean, he's, you know, right?
Well, here's what we do know from the reporting. And I don't really, to be honest with you, I don't come to a clean conclusion myself because it is possible. What we know from the reporting is they land and it's quickly they determine, so that it pops a right tire under the right fuselage of the landing gear, and it's grounded. They can't fly out, and it's a problem with the brake gear, and the Trump campaign learns that, okay, we could spend $30,000 to FedEx the part up from Florida, but they decide to. Trump is cheap and he doesn't want to pay for it, so he has an intern drive it up from Florida. or maybe Manafort made that decision, right? I mean, that's another way of grounding the plane. Like, it's not Manafort out there with like a Bowie knife, you know, sticking it in the wheel, right? Like, there's many ways you could do this. You know, I'd heard there was a backup plane that was cleared by the Secret Service. I mean, the other thing you have to remember, too, is that whatever you're flying in has to get re-cleared by the Secret Service. So there was a backup plane that they could have brought in. They didn't. Trump decides to stay there overnight. And the next morning, they have breakfast at the governor's mansion. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump fly out very early to get there so that they can meet Pence for the very first time. And after the breakfast meeting, Trump and Pence go into the basement, into the bunker of the governor's mansion, his furnished basement, and they get down to brass tacks. And Trump looks at Pence and he says, Mike, I need killers. Are you going to be a killer? He's like, look at all these phone calls I got from Chris Christie. Christie is a killer. Are you going to be a killer? And Pence is very calm, very placid. He looks at him and he says, I'm not a killer. I don't need this. I could run for re-election as governor and be fine. I will help you lobby Congress. I will help you fundraise. I will help you with evangelical voters. I will help in the Rust Belt, but I'm not going to be a killer. And if you do want a killer and you find somebody else, I will support you and whoever that person is. And Trump is just astounded by this. And Trump looks at him. He says, why don't you want this? He said, Christie, he's calling me right now. Christie wants this. Why don't you want this? And a little flash of ingenuity. Pence looks at him and says, well, Mr. Trump, you are in my house. Your family is here with us. So obviously the feeling is mutual. Why do you want me?
Trump could have said, well, because my plane's grounded. I had no choice. I am stuck here.
Right.
You think I want to be in Indiana? I mean,
well, Mike, there are a lot of assumptions built into that phrase. What it does, though, in that moment, and we reported for the first time in the book, and it makes total sense, is that it forces Trump to respect Mike Pence.
Hmm. That forced him to say, so because of course, the conventional wisdom is that Trump wants yes people, people who will fawn on him, will praise him, that mm-hmm. he's looking for sycophants. And you're saying that the moment that Pence won Trump's respect was when he pushed back and said, I don't need this.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. I mean, based on my reporting, based on what Pence's people told me, and it kind of made sense to me, too, because, look, Trump is an impulsive creature. And, you know, later that night, that Wednesday, July 13th, at 6:30 o'clock, he calls up and he offers the running mate spot to Pence. And they say yes. And everyone, they think that's it. They prepare to fly out to Manhattan for the big announcement the next day, Thursday, July 14th, and that's that. Christie finds out about this mm-hmm. because Pence is flying into Teterboro, New Jersey, and the state troopers tell him that the governor of Indiana is flying in.
Yeah, he can connect the dots.
Yeah. So he calls up Trump and on that Thursday, and he calls him out. He says, Donald, what is this? He says, look, it's fine if you want to give it to Mike, but just tell me. He's like, be honest with me. Come on, we've known each other a very long time. And Trump says, don't worry about it. He's like, come on, Chris, like, we know each other, like, nothing's real, nothing's final. And he's like, Chris, come on, I'm ready to do this. Like, just, you know, all you got to do is tell me. And he's like, Chris, you and Mary Pat, be ready. Just, you guys be ready. Stand by the phone. I'm going to call you, okay? And then he goes on that night on Greta Van Susteren. So then they cancel. So what happens is that Thursday, they cancel the rollout of Pence. And they tell Pence's people that it's because of the terrorist attack in Nice, France. It's a horrific attack. Although it should be noted that other global events had not derailed Trump campaign events before. This one does. And he goes on Greta Van Susteren that night, and Greta asks him, says, well, hey, you know, like, we're talking about the terrorist attack, get through that. But also, we heard that Mike Pence is going to be your running mate. And Trump's like, no. Nothing's final. Nothing's, he's like, we got all kinds of great candidates. We got Newt Gingrich, we got Christie, we got Mike Pence, everything's, look, nothing's settled yet. So Pence's people hear this, and they call up Manafort and Trump, apoplectic, and they're like, well, hey, you guys canceled this rollout on us, and now you're saying nothing's a done deal? And there's a deadline in here for Mike Pence. It's a deadline that only matters to Mike Pence, not to Trump. Legally, to run for office, he has to be off the ballot of Indiana by Friday at noon, within 24 hours, even less, 18, 12 hours. He has to be off the ballot, or he cannot legally run for vice president because he cannot run for two offices. So he's running for re-election as governor. They have to take his name off the ballot. That's the filing deadline. And Pence's people make a very real decision. This is real politic. They understand that Trump's word doesn't mean a thing. And they tell them, look, we're not going to leave the Pences stranded. We're not going to leave them without a job, because what if, you know, what happens if you decide at the last minute that, oh, Christie is really the best pick, or, you know, we really like Newt Gingrich now. Like, for Trump, it doesn't matter. But now the Pences are out of a job because they're not running for governor or vice president. So they tell him, they say, look, you have to announce this publicly. Trump balks at this. So does Manafort. It gets down to the wire the next day, Friday, 11 a.m., July 15th, 2016.
1 hour to go.
Exactly. They got Matt Morgan, the deputy counsel, is in the state house, ready to walk the papers over to the Secretary of State's office, taking Pence's name off the ballot to run for vice president. They just need to know. They call up Trump and they say, you got to declare this publicly or we're backing out. And man, Trump and Manafort are like, come on, guys, we told you everything's fine. We're going to make the announcement tomorrow. Yeah. Well, it's Nick Ayers and Marty Obst who are running the show, and they're no fools. And they say, no, we're backing out unless you do something, unless you say it publicly. And now Trump and Manafort are freaking out. They're like, what do you want us to do? And they're like, well, just say it. Just do something. They're like, can we tweet it? They're like, yes, tweet it. So at 11 a.m. on Friday, July 15th, 2016, Trump tweets it. And they forced him to stick to his word. It's incredible.
It is an incredible story. I wish we had more time because, you know, the fact that they thought this was going to be a 4-month adventure that's turned into a 4-year adventure. Let me just, you know, briefly here. This last summer was really a tough one for Mike Pence. I mean, we know that Mike Pence has had to be as boring as possible, that he had to become a ghost during the Mueller investigation, that he has again and again tried to prove himself as the ultimate loyalist, despite all of the differences between them. But this has been a tough summer for Mike Pence. And it does feel like the hazing is not over. The Trump tests of his loyalty we haven't exhausted all of that. The Trump is not completely comfortable with Mike Pence yet.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it reported a little bit about how Jared and Ivanka were talking about replacing Pence. And, you know, they argue that it's not real. I'll tell you what is real, though, is Pence's actions and how Pence World handles this. And they are afraid of getting spiked from the ticket in 2020. That's a real, they don't think it's likely to happen, but it's a real possibility. That's how you get these stretches like in July, where, you know, he goes out to New Hampshire and he gets called back at the last minute. And so all kind of a big mystery. What was very revealing for me was that some of Pence's aides and allies were just angry at Trump. They're like, yeah, there goes Trump again, yanking on the leash. It's like, it's so demeaning. And, you know, a week and a half later, Pence goes down to a border detention camp. And, right, oh, it was brutal. And, I mean, this human, the misery of those people in cages, it was so sad. And, you know, one Pence advisor told me, it's like, that should have been Trump down there. That shouldn't have been Mike Pence doing that. That should have been Trump in that, you know, looking at these men in cages. And it was a rough, rough time for him. And they feeling a little beat up. These loyalty tests that they still has to go through.
But this is the long game. And as you point out in the book, Mike Pence has been thinking about being president since 2008. And this is the price he has to pay for the long game, that he thinks that, 2024 will be his year. So what do you think the odds are on a scale of, you know, 0 to 100% that Mike Pence will still be on the ticket next year?
Oh, I think it's probably 90%, 90, 95, more than likely.
That sounds about right. And does within Pence World, do they have an understanding of how much damage this 4 years or 8 years is doing to his brand? I mean, does he honestly think that being the guy that when the president puts his water bottle down, he puts his water bottle down, that somehow people will look at him and say, yes, that's the leader that we need for the free world?
Yeah, they do. Karen knows it. That's why she was angry at him. It's Pence has to control the Trump base going forward. That's the only way he does this. Fittingly enough, he's doing his game plan is the same thing as the other vice president running for president right now, right? Joe Biden, which is you have to run the inside game. It has to be one of like a coronation almost. I mean, of course, Biden's coronation is not going so hot. So maybe that's a precursor for Pence, but I will say this. He probably has a better claim on it than Nikki Haley. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks that Nikki Haley is like a Trump loyalist. So Pence he's pretty good at playing this game. He's pretty good at like carrying it forward.
I mean, rationally, he's doing probably the only thing that given the rules of the game and given the guidelines of the guardrails of Trump world, this is all that he can do. Tom, thank you so much for joining me and spending all of this time. Tom LoBianco's book is Piety and Power. It is the story of Mike Pence, who, despite the fact that he really wants to project that boring image, is really kind of a fascinating, paradoxical character. So, Tom, thanks for spending time with us on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.